Welcome to the Strabane's Hall podcast. This series on successful succession planning reviews the important role that property has to play in securing wealth for the next generation. We're thrilled to have with us on this occasion two fantastic guests. Lucien Cook is Head of Residential Research at Savills and is one of the UK's leading and most quoted commentators on the UK housing market. Mark Ashbridge, our second guest, is the owner and director of Ashbridge Partners, who advise on and arrange commercial loans and residential mortgages for their clients, including landed estate families. In this episode, you'll hear about the findings that Savills research has uncovered and what's happening right now in the market. And you'll hear about real cases of how clients use bespoke planning solutions to help families transfer wealth between generations, and more about the rural renaissance that's really taking place. But I won't go on. Let me hand you over now to Nicholas Tubkin, Senior Client Director for Strabane's Hall.
Well, I'm delighted to be joined today by Lucien Cook of Savills and Mark Ashbridge of Ashbridge Partners. Lucien joined Savills in 1993 and is now Head of UK residential research for the firm. So we're delighted to have him with us. And Mark founded Ashbridge Partners in 2012 and looks after specialist lending and finance solutions for private clients with a particular focus on landed estates. We particularly wanted to have the podcast today because, as you would expect, the majority of our clients have properties in the UK, both ones they live in and also significant investments in residential real estate. So it's a really pertinent topic for our clients. No more than ever at the moment, residential property was notably affected by lockdown, but also equally notable has been the quite marked bounce back in the market that we've seen of late. So we are very much looking forward to exploring this topic with Lucien and Mark. So welcome both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
And Lucien, if I could start by asking you for a quick update from your side. As I touched on just there, residential property was impacted by lockdown quite significantly, but there seems to have been quite a significant bounce back in the market. And it'd be interesting to hear your views on where you think the market stands and where you see it going over the medium to long term.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been very surprised by the extent to which activity in the housing market has bounced back. I mean, there was no doubt that it was very heavily affected by lockdown. If you take a measure such as the number of properties for which agreed sales were occurring, then some data which we've got from a data provider called 20CI, who basically look at all of the websites and look when properties are marked sold subject to contract. That tells us that in April, that the levels of agreed sales fell by something like 85% year on year. In about April, we sort of decided, given back end of April, given the lack of data that resulted from that, we ought to do a few client surveys. And they started to give us the hints that perhaps lockdown was having some effects which we wouldn't normally expect. Normally, when you have a sort of any kind of economic downturn, you tend to see people become far more reluctant to move. You often will find that that's accompanied by a housing market downturn. But at the back end of April, we had a survey and it showed us that a net balance of people who were on our books had become more committed to moving as a result of the experience of lockdown. Now, clearly, those are people with quite a stable income, probably quite secure employment, and a lot of financial stability behind them. They've probably got quite a lot of equity in their own home. But nonetheless, that was surprising. What's been as surprising, I suppose, is the extent to which activities come back. The most recent data we have, and we sit here at the back end of August, is that if you look at those number of agreed sales in the last few weeks, and you compare it to the same time last year, across the housing market as a whole, they're up by something in the order of 75%. If you go to the market above £1 million, then activity levels are double where they were last year. So that deficit that we saw in transaction levels has really changed. What's interesting, though, is normally if you get that big bounce in activity, you tend to see a bit of a spike in prices. And what is also very apparent is that, you know, whilst buyers and sellers have become more committed to move and even more committed to move, if anything, since April, the market's still relatively price sensitive. So people are still aware of that economic backdrop. So on the one hand, I think you've got the economic drivers, and on the other, you've got some huge changes in lifestyle and the way people view their lifestyle, life, work, balance the home, what that means for things like accessibility to Wi-Fi, outdoor space, and everything that goes with it. And what that has kind of done is it's, in the prime market, it's done two things. It's driven people down the traditional wealth corridors. So classically, think Southwest London, start in Fulham, end up in Wimbledon. They've moved down that corridor to find a bigger property with more space and perhaps a garden. Or it's pushed demand out to the country. And there it's done a few things. So the people who are going to continue to work in London for 3 to 4 days a week, very strong on accessible countryside, location that is commutable. Other people with a complete lifestyle change are going further afield. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot going on in the market.
That's great. Thanks, Lucien. And I guess now might be an interesting time to pass over to Mark, because your area of specialty is landed estates. And it would be interesting to hear, firstly, your views on the lending market and trends you've seen recently in that, and also particularly whether you've seen this trend of people relocating from London to the country.
Yes, thank you, Nick. And fascinated to hear what Lucien had to say on that. It certainly ties in with the with what we've been seeing on the ground. And perhaps before sort of going into that, maybe it's perhaps worth just summarising what we've seen in the finance market in general, and you know, to certainly including on the residential side, which is obviously of great importance to many, many people. Key difference between this scenario here in 2020 and the one that we all experienced back in 2008-2009 is that the banks are in really good shape. So that's been enormously positive. They've got the capital, they've got the money to lend. The other main point is the pressure that we've seen on human resources. So certain high street banks who have got processing centres overseas, those were for a time shut down because of COVID issues. Those countries, and then here in the UK, with all of their staff working from home, working remotely, many of them self-isolating or unable to work at that time, that combined with the mortgage payment holidays, which were being offered to all and sundry and which were taken up by several million people, has really been the perfect storm in terms of testing the resources of those lenders. So it's been very much a case of that the money has been there, but that the banks have struggled to provide the resources in which to get them out to market. One other interesting point to add to that, I suppose, is that we deal with a lot of private banks, and a number of those are relatively small. They have tended to have the resources, and they've actually done really well out of this because they've been able to move quickly. And again, coming back to what Lucien is saying, then where, you know, people have seen once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to purchase that house that they've always wanted, that, you know, perhaps as a result of COVID has come forward. You know, we've seen quite dramatic changes across many families, you know, with sadly loss of life and people having to make really significant life changes. So this has prompted a lot of activity, and I'm seeing it every day. You know, we're getting a lot of inquiries, all of which point to people making really significant decisions. So that's very much the residential market. As you've said, you know, I specialize very much in the landed estate world, which is in part an extension of what we see in the residential market. Landed estates tend to be very capital strong. They're intergenerational businesses. Many of them have been around for several hundred years. Some of my clients have been, you know, where they are for 1,000 years, back to the Norman Conquest, obviously, and before. So this, as a blip alongside the fire of London and the Black Death and 2008 financial crisis, this isn't the biggest thing that's ever happened to them. But the key headlines are that the banks are very keen to lend to estates, and that includes, you know, the smaller farms or small residential estates that you know, Lucien at Savills might you know, might come across in the home counties and those higher value regions that he talked about, you know, M40 corridor, etc. So that also coupled with base rate falling from 75 basis points down to 10, interest margins have edged up a little, but certainly nothing at all to take away that significant drop in overall debt cost today. So for those that can get the money, that can access a lender who actually can process it, then debt cost is cheaper than it's ever been. And that's both, you know, the short-term rate, which is, let's say, base plus the margin, or long-term money, you know, which is 10-year cost of funds at maybe 50 basis points or less, plus a margin equals, you know, a 10-year fixed rate, perhaps at low 2%. So that environment means that there are many opportunities that estates can take advantage of, or anybody else for that matter, which are going to cost less from a debt perspective than they would have cost before.
That's great. Thank you, Mark. Really interesting, and particularly touching on, you know, the longer term perspective that London estates frequently take when thinking about their property. From our perspective, we frequently talk to our clients about property in the context of their broader wealth management and financial planning, and how to achieve intergenerational transfer of wealth from one generation to the next, which can be difficult to achieve with property for a number of reasons, including perhaps the older generation not wanting to move, and some of the tax and practical considerations involved in passing one property to another. And Lucien, it would be interesting to get your perspective on that topic, because you've very kindly given us an update on where you see the market as it stands in the relatively short term. But do you have a perspective on where you see property prices and the property market going over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years or so?
Well, I mean, I think Mark's raised some very interesting points there. I mean, short term, clearly what we've got is a number of lifestyle drivers which are driving activity in the housing market, but this economic backdrop that says that that's not necessarily resulting in a growth in prices. I think to get price growth, what you're going to need is more confidence in the general economy and people's job security. But when that comes, it is increasingly likely it will come against the context of a very, very low interest rate environment. And essentially for the period of the last 5 years, when we've been forecasting house prices, we've been doing so against the expectation that interest rates will rise. They've not really done that, but there's always been that expectation. Of course, what that does is start to constrain affordability, particularly in this age of mortgage regulation. But if you have this very low interest rate environment, then you don't necessarily the market, whether that's for people who choose to borrow or have to borrow. So I think that creates quite an interesting dynamic. I think that is likely to underpin both the speed of the recovery, but also the longer term house price growth prospects. But of course, we do live in an age of mortgage regulation, so it's not going to be quite like previous times, because the lender's going to build in a margin to look at what happens to affordability if interest rates do rise. So you have got some breaks. You have got some breaks within the system. In terms of the wider estate planning point, I think Mark will know that, you know, having been in Savills since 1993, I've had two lives essentially. My first was as a land agent, and what I used to specialize in there was valuation for tax purposes. And back in the day, I used to do a lot of valuations from people who were absolutely desperate to hang on to their family home. And they got themselves into lease carve out schemes and Lady Ingram schemes and pre-owned assets taxation and everything that went with it. For a valuer, you could not have more fun in those times. I mean, it was absolutely superb. But I think what there has been now is a bit of a change. And I think there is an increased realization amongst that older generation that the equity which they sit on in their main residence is something which their children and grandchildren look upon with envy. And actually, they're probably taking a view that they will, you know, they have more of an obligation to provide for other family members to help them step up and get on and step up the property ladder. And as a result, not only through this process have we seen that people have got an increased propensity to upsize if they're, say, under 50, but those who are over 50 are looking at downsizing more. So like that really practical measure where they downsize, they unlock some of the equity which they've got in their main home, and they pass it down a generation or two to help others get on the housing ladder. And I suspect, you know, I suspect they're also doing that or thinking about that with an eye to inheritance tax, because one of the things that that we will see going forward is clearly the government has created a significant level of debt and had to incur a significant level of debt through furloughing and supporting the economy. Not now, but at some point in the future, that will mean higher levels of taxation. And if that means higher levels of taxation, of course, tax planning, particularly if we see any form of increased wealth tax, I suspect going to be another driver for people to say, actually, look, let's right size, let's go down the scale a bit, let's get some of the cash out of our estate and down to other generations.
Fantastic. Thanks, Lucy. That's really interesting and particularly relevant as it relates to wealth planning between generations. And Mark, it'd be interesting to hear if you have any recent case studies or recent experience that you've been working on where you've seen clients using finance to ease the flow of property from one generation to the next.
Absolutely. Yes, I think that ties in nicely. Before I do that, I might just... one observation from Lucien's comments there. I'm not so far from 50. And you talk about, you know, above 50 downsizing. My wife thinks we need to upsize. So maybe I'm just too slow in this. We should have moved quicker. But that's one for me to take home and to discuss with her, Lucien. Thank you for those pointers. I've got on a piece of paper here two or three examples of where we've used debt to facilitate the succession. And I'll start with the perhaps the easiest one, or the one that we've certainly seen quite a lot of in recent years is, and let's just take this as an example, you know, a lady of 80 some years sat in a very valuable house in London, you know, several millions of value. That valuation has perhaps fallen upon her because of the way the market's gone. And, you know, Lucien would give us the figures of the dramatic increase in London prices over the last, say, 30 years, relative to even to the rest of the country. And she wished to hand down some of that capital value to other members of the family. And so what we did there was a lifetime mortgage was put in place, which ticked a lot of boxes. It meant that she could continue living the lifestyle that she had been accustomed to, because the lifetime mortgage interest rolls up. It was deemed to be very inheritance tax efficient, and that the next generation got to benefit from that capital to go into their house purchase so that they could move on and start to live the sort of life that they wanted to. And of course, all of this has been made more difficult by people's longevity. If you went back 20, 30 years, then people didn't expect generally to be living into their 80s and 90s. So we've got this demographic issue as well. Other things that we've seen are where perhaps the next generation, and let's look at this in a sort of an estate scenario. So the next generation wants to take on the principal house, and mum and dad therefore need to find another property. But of course, they need the capital to do that. So let's say the son and his wife come and take on the principal house, but they actually purchase it from the parents. Hopefully, it often is the case, is that the next generation have got their own career, so they've got an income, so we can raise them a mortgage. It's quite possible that, you know, we can get them best in market terms, which in these days is, you know, is a 1-point-something% deal rather than a 2-point-something% deal. If it's 50% loan to value or less, then it could be interest only, which makes the affordability phenomenally achievable. And then, of course, with that transfer of capital, mum and dad can go off and buy somewhere else and achieve that downsizing. So that's really positive. And then the other thing that we see going on is let's say when it's a bigger, it's perhaps a bigger estate or farming an estate unit, where there are siblings, and the policy is that the siblings who are not in effect inheriting the whole of the business, that they do have a share of it, because that's the principal asset of the family. And so we're able to structure something so that those siblings can in effect be bought out. And again, you know, looking at the debt cost, and it's a very good point that Lucia made about, you know, the debt cost levels today versus where we were just 6 months ago, and certainly where we were 12 years ago, so many more things are achievable at a pure farming level, where we've got farming businesses for sale that produce, let's say, a typical yield of 1.5%. We, at this moment in time, we are doing a deal for someone where the debt cost on a variable rate basis is a little over 1.5%, which I find astounding, but our job is to go to the market and get the best that we can. So you've got there, and Lucian will find this fascinating, I think, because obviously in our history, his and mine, of being involved in farming businesses, certainly never in my lifetime has there been as close an alignment of potential income yield with potential short-term debt cost. So there's sort of three examples for you, Nick.
That's great. Thank you, Mark. It is really remarkable how cheap borrowing is at the moment. And Lucian, as you said, I think that certainly will have a significant impact on the future trajectory of house prices. Maybe we could turn to thinking about international buyers when it comes to UK property, because certainly in my experience, the most comparable situation to our current state of flux that I can think of is the 2008 crisis. And that was very shortly followed by a significant investment in London and UK property by international buyers, which really propped up the market and fueled the next stage of growth. And I guess, Lucian, it'd be interesting to hear your perspective with interest rates being so affordable and also with sterling being relatively weak. Do you see that trend happening again?
Well, look, I mean, every previous time we've had a downturn, it has always been the central London market and overseas buyers taking advantage of both a correction in house prices and sterling that has kick-started the market. It's always been the catalyst. This time it's a bit different, actually. It tends to be the domestic buyers who are doing that. And I think it's those who are more affected by the lifestyle changes. In reality, whilst we've seen transaction levels in central London start to recover, given the international travel restrictions that we've had, the increase in volumes hasn't been nearly as strong as it's been in other parts, of the country. I mean, that's an interesting dynamic, because I think when you release those international travel restrictions as they gradually release, and people, if they're doing a big investment particularly, still want to be able to see, touch and feel that property, then you can see that demand coming in, because the central London values 20% below where they were in 2014. Add on the currency play, and for a dollar-based buyer, it's more like a 40% currency-adjusted discount. That looks pretty compelling. You just need the other circumstances, I think, to be right to bring that demand back into the market. But the other thing that you'll see is I don't think it will be confined to those markets. You will also see them pretty active in the likes of St. George's Hill and Wentworth. But I think also increasingly a bit further afield. I think, you know, one of the things that we found, I think, is what we would refer to as a rural renaissance and the rediscovery of country living and the country house, something which became, I wouldn't say unfashionable, but perhaps a little less fashionable over the period of the last 10 years or so. And what that means, of course, is if you compare those properties to, say, their comparables, if you're in Hampshire, for example, and you've got a prime property in Winchester compared to one in the villages outside, that property in Winchester's performed much better. And that's created a bit of a value gap. And it means that some of those country houses in particular are looking like pretty good value at the point in which we're rediscovering our love affair with country living. So that creates a very interesting dynamic. I think combined with the interest rates, that means that there is the prospect for some reasonable medium-term house price growth. We're forecasting that prices in central London over the period of the next 5 years could go up by in the order of 16%. We're pretty close to that in the prime regional markets. I think your more domestic markets of prime London might not quite keep pace with that. But you can see, you know, all of the drivers are there For the international buyers, of course, what you need is more movement, more footfall, central London again becoming the vibrant place that we've all seen it in the past.
Great stuff. Thanks, Lucien. And I guess, Mark, as a man of the country yourself, it would be interesting to get your perspective on the trends that you see towards the country and you know, whether that's something that you've experienced and seen demand for of late.
Absolutely. And, you know, and we do see, and many of the conversations we've been having over recent weeks is that people have made clear decisions that they want to step outside of town in some form or other, either permanently or, you know, more permanent place out of town. I think of one example of a family, very successful family, living in West London, not having anything outside of town, and actually saying, not that we want a country house, but actually we want a farm. And the advice, you know, that I was able to give was, well, you know, you could look, based on your circumstances, you could look actually at quite a serious farm. I mean, I'm thinking 500, 600, 700 acres, perhaps, in, you know, Dorset, probably, maybe parts of Gloucestershire, round towards Banbury, that sort of region. And I guess the boxes that they're looking for are, they want a decent house, they want plenty of the other sort of toys, you know, which might include a swimming pool, tennis court sort of thing. But actually they do also want what some people call a working farm. And added to that, with, you know, this much greater focus on climate change and our long-term sustainability as a species on this planet, also wanting to get involved in some of those green initiatives, renewable initiatives as a part of that business. Now, that was really, really fascinating conversation that I had with that client, and I'm sure that they will go on to, you know, actually to do something. That's certainly, you know, very interesting, and to see that happening.
Great stuff. Thanks, Mark. I notice that our time is ticking. So thank you both very much indeed for your insight and for your thoughts on this topic. I know that our clients will really appreciate it and value your comments. Any last thoughts from you both in terms of how you see the market evolving perhaps over the remainder of this year, and any hints or tips that you would give to our clients? Maybe starting with you, Mark.
Well, I will just add one more thing in, actually, perhaps before even slightly addressing that, which is, and Lucien quite rightly has given the example of every time there's been an economic blip, you know, the international market has come in to take advantage of that. On the land side, then what we had seen in the early 2000s was what we called the Danish invasion. And they were coming over here, raising debt, either with Danish banks or with UK banks, gearing up farms very aggressively and buying decent slugs of land, typically in the eastern counties, for £3,000, £4,000, £5,000 an acre, which at that time that the domestic buyer thought was over the top and overly aggressive. And then we did see significant land price inflation. And, you know, in today's world, there's an enormous range from top to bottom, depending on location and land quality and local market competition. But people tend to talk in the range of sort of £8,000 to £10,000 an acre. So we've seen that dramatic movement. It could be that, again, with the weakness of sterling and the debt cost aspect, that we could see a new foreign invasion of some kind into UK land. That's interesting. Obviously, there's a lot going on there. In terms of looking to the future, I think one of the things that I perhaps haven't said is that all of this from the banking perspective means that banks are making less money. So we've got the double hit of, as interest rates fall, bank profitability falls also. And that's to do with the relative balance between the cash that they've got sat on deposit that they don't pay interest on versus the money that they're lending for a margin. The metrics of it mean low interest rates equal low level of profitability for banks. So you've got that element. And obviously they've got a legacy of deals that they've got in place, whether it's residentially or commercially, that were done on terms last year and the year before and and many years, you know, many years preceding, which run on, they're committed to that. That's in part one of the reasons why I believe that we will probably still see a bit more hardening in interest margins or interest rates as a whole, accepting that over this last 6 months, that rates have dropped significantly from even from where they were, and that we'll probably see a bit of a gradual uptick. But the other point, which is really important also, is that banks will be making significant provisions for losses. You know, we've got an enormous restructuring going on in many businesses, certainly in the retail, high street sector. And these were all trends which were all happening at a pace. But as many commentators have said, you know, we're seeing and we have seen perhaps 5 years change over 5 months. And so the fallout of that will definitely mean that the banks, albeit they've got strong bases, which is great news, and that's all credit to the hard work that's been done since 2008, but there will need to be perhaps some readjustment along the way so that they can absorb the losses which come down the track. And of course, that's enormously dependent on how successful the economic stimulus package has proven to be. And what's going to happen. And then, of course, the other thing which no one's mentioned yet, and I'm just going to dive in there first to beat you, but it's Brexit, of course. And that's going to clearly play a big part in our economic future as a country. So I think, in summary, banks, still they're strong. They have got money to lend. They are, at the moment, challenged still by their human resources. But the money is there to lend to the right customers. We might see a bit of tightening, but when we look at our typical client, and this probably includes all of us, who tend to be the more slightly better positioned, strong capital base, decent incomes, then those people are in an enormously strong position to do lots of things, to make lots of choices. So, Nick, thank you very much. That's where I'll stop.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Mark. And I'm only sorry that we didn't manage to get through a podcast without mentioning Brexit. But perhaps it had to be said. And Lucian, over to you for some final thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think the level of momentum which we've had in the market over the summer, in the housing market over the summer, has taken a lot of us by surprise. If you look at some of our lead indicators, so if you look at the levels of viewings and applicants registering in the top end of the housing market at the moment, then that would certainly suggest that that will continue through into the autumn. I think because of Brexit and because of the unwinding of furlough and the fact that government support at the level it's been won't last forever, there is a risk that we lose some of that momentum into the fourth quarter of the year. But of course, what we also have is a stamp duty holiday. And I suspect what will happen as the end of that stamp duty holiday approaches at the end of March, so again, you will start to see people sort of pretty motivated to buy at that point. You know, when you get above £500,000, it's a £15,000 saving. It's capped at that, but it's still £15,000. And just the ability to not pay some stamp duty can do amazing things to people's commitment to buy in a particular market. So I think, you know, that will sustain the market in the early part of next year. Thereafter, it's all about the pace and speed of the economic recovery.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Lucian. And thanks to both of you. That's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Lots and lots of food for thought. And it would be great to perhaps revisit this topic in the early part of 2021 to see what's happened, what's changed, and where we see the market going forward. But for now, thank you both very much indeed.
Yes, thanks, Nick, and huge thanks to our two guest speakers, Lucian Cook and Mark Attridge, for their time. I hope you found this as insightful as we did. If you would like to talk through yours or your client's succession planning needs, please contact us through the Strabane's Hall website. I'm Gillian Wilson, and if you'd like to be featured on a future podcast, please reach out to me directly. I hope you enjoyed the Strabane's Hall podcast. Look out for the next episode in the series on tax planning.